We're going to go straight into the next session, which is White Cube, Black Room. It's a panel session where we'll have three short presentations from three very distinguished guests. Joyce Hinterding, who's an Australian artist working in sound and video, and Michael Connor, who's a freelance curator and has worked as a curator with the BFI, and Catherine Weir, who's curator of film and video from Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane. And the session will be chaired by Alexi Glass.
For those of you who don't know who David... It's David Haynes and Joyce Hinterding, and we've been collaborating for 10 years exactly this year, which is quite a remarkable collaborative effort, I have to say. David brings to the collaboration more of a literary interest. He's originally trained as a painter, and he's a 3D animator, and has very much kind of an interest in film. I bring a much more of an interest in phenomena, object arts, and sound art. But we both are, I guess, very interested in sensation and immersion. And we've both been deeply involved in installation for the last 10 years. So all of our moving image works are installed works. We may have shown some works as single channel performance works, but usually they've been in a live performance situation because we both play music as well. So it has been said that we are the fictive and the phenomenal, and that I guess our work kind of forms a tension between that, between fiction and phenomena. And what I'm going to do today is just talk about four works quite briefly. And I guess just these works are installed, and talk about how they are installed into gallery spaces, and I guess what our approach has been. Now, if I get caught, I've got some tricky bits of technology running on this computer, and I hope it all works. So Catherine talked about Earth Star. This was exhibited last year at GOMA. And this is stop frame animated footage shot with a hydrogen alpha solar telescope. And this is a big adventure for us. It took us, I guess, we have quite a history of both using the video camera and also of generating the video footage or generating the moving image out of the computer. So we do a lot of animation and 3D animation. But bringing in the telescope and taking it straight out of the telescope was quite an amazing experience. The sound you can hear here is not the sound from the installation. The sound is the sound of those antennas outside. It sounded quite different inside the installation. In the installation, and I'll show you the... Even though this is really classic footage, what I think a substantial part of our collaboration is that David and I work together mostly because together we can do everything, and we work out of our home studio. We do all parts of the production are done by us. We don't outsource any of our process. So this is our footage. It's shot from New South Wales, in the Blue Mountains, and also some shot in Western Australia. The telescope looks, it's a hydrogen alpha telescope, so it basically looks at one light frequency coming away from the sun, and that's why you get this particular resolution. And the work itself is authored into high definition, which has been quite, I think this work could only be high definition because resolution that you actually need. I mean, video 720 by 576 is just such a low resolution that you really, the image really suffers for it. And I'm going to move on, actually. The producing that work at high definition meant that we could see a lot of the stuff that we could see coming off the, because it's all of the footage that's been shot through the telescope's been shot onto digital SLR and then compiled in compositing software. And you can see things that you just really, you know, 5 years ago you just wouldn't have seen that in a video. I mean, it would have had to have been shot on film. But now, obviously, with the changes in technology, video has these kind of new possibilities. This is an overview of the actual installation. And what you can see is that we have this sculptural component in there. And the sculptural component is in two parts. In the centre there, they are two very low-frequency radio antenna. It's 1 kilometre of 0.6 copper magnet wire that I'll show you in a minute. You can see it's plugged directly into the sound system with some filtering so we don't blow up the speakers, which we did do in Perth. I walked into the exhibition at the opening and we turned the volume up because of the or the people who were there, and I could smell the speakers. And there was no tweeters left. It didn't manage to kill the bottoms, but killed the top. So I'm just going to... And then on the far right, left-hand side, you can see there are two refrigeration units, and in those refrigeration units is aromachemistry. David's currently been doing his PhD and doing an investigation into perfume, scent, looking at it through recent research that's been published by Luca Turin on that follows along the concept that the way that we smell is that we can smell the vibration of the molecules. And so this is a very different way of thinking about smell, and this work kind of looks, it's looking at the sun through a single light frequency. Our sound is stopped down, so we're really listening to a very narrow frequency range, and in the refrigeration unit at the back are two ozones, which are explorations of smell at a particular frequency. So this is quite an abstract work in many respects. Now, this is my QuickTime VR, and if this craps out, we're in trouble. But, it seems to be working. As you can see on the table here, there's a mixing desk, and it was really important. Like Raphael, I'm quite interested in people being able to see what's actually going on, and one of the interesting things about this is that these objects are plugged directly into the sound system and the sound system is completely visible. There's nothing hidden in here. And the filtering is, it's really just a graphic equalizer, so it's really just chopping. So we're just listening to a very narrow frequency range. As we go around the room, I've never had a QuickTime VR to play with in one of these before. You'll see the two refrigeration units. And there's a little bit of Marshall McLuhan in here. There's hot and cold. And we were quite interested in the formalism of this, the hotness of the image, which, if you'll remember from McLuhan's writings, hot was in fact passive, and cold was interactive. And so, of course, the refrigeration units with the ozone aromachemistry and in them is very interactive because people had to take it and put it on and took it away with them. And we've now, I think there's a really fantastic article that's just been published in real time by a woman who took some of these smelling strips away with her and then wrote about it sort of,
I think nearly a month later, and it's very interesting, her reflection upon the exhibition through the matrix of the smell. Okay, now let's see if I can get out of here. Yes. Okay, so in the refrigeration units is ozone 1, ionisation, and fumes, perfumes, aroma chemistry is a very evocative kind of linguistic and writing that goes with it, and David's sort of exploring that. But down the bottom, you'll see the chemistry that's in it, and ozonol, helionyl, ocean carboxyaldehyde, hydrol, maritimer, hedione, ISOE super. It's a really quite, it's an extraordinary thing. David spent an enormous amount of time, you know, probably in the whole time that I've known him, generating 3D animations. And his current work is on, he's got a blog called 21st Century Holograms, in which he's writing on the ability for this synthetic, these are all synthesized aroma chemistry, aroma molecules, and their ability to put pictures in your head. And the ozone 1 ionization is a burnt smell. Is it the burnt one? No. This is the watery one. So we've got two, and this is ozone 2 terrestrial. This one smells like burning electricity, and the other one smells like the ozone that you get off the ocean. And the images that arrive in your brain are quite strong. I had this last year at this time, actually right now, I was in England at the AV Festival, and I saw a performance of John Cage's Variation 7. And I was standing with Douglas Kahn, and after 10 minutes, the room, after they'd switched on maybe 100 pieces of really old electrical equipment, we were listening to it, and it sounded amazing. Soviet France was performing it, and it was full of people. But the room filled with that smell of hot electrical equipment. And I said to Douglas, you know, it smells like modernism. Anyway, it's been very interesting, and David's research has been really, it's been a great, I've watched his vocabulary expand, and it's really quite amazing. We now have a perfume lab in our as a part of our studio, and we published a little publication last year called The Immaterials, Language, Molecules and Vibration, which I'm not going to talk about. But, okay. So the next work I'm going to talk about is electromagnetic composition for building plants and stars. And the reason I want to talk about this is because it's an architectural response. And in terms of thinking about the white cube, black box, this is a building in Sendai, and it's built by Toyo Ito. And his idea was that it was a glass cube that had 13 light wells in it. And the seventh floor is an international gallery. We were there, and we spent 2 weeks and to make a work there. And this is the work we made. We wrapped one of the columns in this copper wire and plugged it all in. And we spent quite a lot of time out near in the local environment, both recording the local electromagnetic environment and also just looking at the vegetation that was growing nearby. And I'm going to... overgrowth, just this
growing over the top of everything else. And it was really interesting. It had this interesting relationship to the electromagnetic environment, where it just sits like a shroud on top of things. But it's also incredibly musical. Especially in Japan, this is probably my most favourite electromagnetic recording that I've got. It's full of clicking and ticking and weird kind of whipping sounds. It's really very, very beautiful. And you can hear the classic solar VLX solar stuff in the background there. This is quite a lot of recording at the time.
Here you can see in the installation is also a box that has an irrational antenna in it, which is where we just stuffed all the wires into a box and then just plugged them straight into that mixing desk. And people were able to mix the sound themselves. I guess the significant thing... There's the box. The thing here is that we're working with... Not necessarily, I mean, these works are contemplative works. They're invitations to their landscape works. They're both the visible landscape and the invisible landscape kind of juxtaposed together. And also they're not about human beings. You know, I'm not asking you to come in and presence in the environment in a sense. It's about, they're reactive. And what I guess I really hope is that these works place people within the flows of the world rather than in charge of them you can't change these works. I don't want people to come in and fiddle with them too much. I mean, I'm happy to have them listen through it, but they can't impose themselves into it. They're not at the centre of the universe of these works. They are inside and a larger sort of flow. The next work I'm going to talk about is Purple Rain. This work was been installed in a number of different countries. And this is a work in which, you'll see here, we're using... it's a work that I guess looks at the broadcast image, it looks at the moving image in terms of the power, the physical electromagnetic power that is pushed behind broadcast television. One of the things that sort of at the beginning of this work was, I think the first time we did it was in 2004, and it was around the time that the Americans went into Iraq, and we were really, and it was the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, and the thing that we were really interested in was what actual literal physical power the media has. It's thousands of watts. You know, those broadcast towers that sit there, they've got 1,000-watt kilowatts of power pumping out images. And, you know, we're all worrying about how much we can get down the telephone line on broadband, and we're not really thinking about what's actually in the air and what kind of images are in the air. So I started listening to the carrier waves so it's a modulated signal television, kind of, you know, basically they pump up a frequency, pump it up, and then they sit the image or information on top of a very pumped up carrier wave. So we started listening to the carrier waves and listening to fluctuations in the carrier waves and listening to fluctuations, not, I guess, just a way of actually somehow playing around with this, you know, how do you evidence this kind of power that's in there? The other thing that this work kind of looks at is the end of the analog signal broadcasting system across the globe. Holland shut down, this is Amsterdam, and we ran a digital system out of Amsterdam. Holland was the first country to shut down its free-to-air terrestrial broadcasting system and go completely digital. And there are political issues, I guess, around going from analog to digital. The analog broadcasting system has propagated little broadcasting televisions, you know, situations all over the world, New Zealand, But once it goes digital, what happens is that the information is just sort of sucked through the internet and it's just rebroadcast and done by other people. So all of those, lots of people will lose their jobs and a lot of local content will be at risk as we go to digital. Plus, if you talk to other people about what the implications of the whole shift to digital are, there are other kinds of military implications in there. They're freeing up airspace. Anyway, so this work, so this mountain here, this is in Sao Paulo for the first time we installed it. In Sao Paulo, we had a cave of antennas and we wanted to see this mountain avalanching, and it's as the broadcast television signal fluctuates, it triggers a homemade piece of electronics that chooses, it's basically a hacked keyboard, and it chooses a different bit of footage off a computer. And basically it's a mountain that's avalanching, and it doesn't matter what you do, the mountain continuously avalanches. In the gallery there are four, this is in Taipei. We had four antennas, we had four tuners, and we were more in the, let's get the most expensive antennas we can get, so they're more like stealth bombers, rather than, you know, like the clutter of caves. I love the sound. I love that it's just basically the video plugged into the audio, but then running through a triggering system. But it's really, it sends me to sleep all the time. It's like that, the hypnosis of 50 hertz is really fantastic. I know I've got, but I have to show you one more thing. I just want to show, this took me so much work to do this. Oh, that's the setup. This is the work we did in November. I just want to show you this. I've got this really great thing I want to show you at the end of this. This is telepathy, and it's an anechoic chamber. And I'm going to just maybe I'll just go through the slide, through the presentation. And there's a little film clip because I actually wanted to talk about this work in terms of influence and how modernism kind of finds its way back through your work. And there's an influence in here that's incredibly, it's really directly from cinema, and it's absolutely perfect, and it's the point that I want to finish on. So this is telepathy. This is the inside of telepathy. This telepathy is a tank. It is immersive and quite confronting. You will experience your tinea as never before. Quite claustrophobic. So I can get out of there. We had about three, four people in there at a time. Was quite okay. Got a bit hot after a while, but the references on the video monitors, we had video broadcasting through the space, which was of Walter Di Maria's Lightning Field, which is a very significant influence for me, given my interest in electronics and those kinds of things. But also, it's the house that's on the Lightning Field, and it looks like the house out of Carlos Castaneda's stories. And so it's a metaphysical house, and it's being broadcast through this space, and it's a really bad reception because we bought one of those really like the worst possible transmitters you could get. Anyway, the other references are obvious, you know, John Cage, the minimalism, but they're all there. Thank you.
This is some kind of space vehicle, right? What for? Solar probe?
I want you to think beyond that. I want to show you this because I value your contribution to my work.
Well, I'm not certain what that's to be.
Fuel conservation, Dr. Bryce. Maybe the key to our project. Ask me.
What?
The question you've been wanting to ask ever since we met.
Are you Lithuanian?
I come from England.
Oh, that's not so terrible. Is this a weapon?
A weapon?
Well, it's too small for interplanetary travel.
So you assume that it's a weapon. Does that matter to you?
Yeah. If I thought that you were building a weapon, you were employing me to help you, I'd have to quit the project.
Don't be suspicious. I know people think me unnecessarily secretive.
If I were you, I'd be secretive.
Would you be comfortable in here?
I think I'd last about 20 minutes.
And then?
I'd start screaming. Wouldn't everyone? Last night I was watching television. I saw these ex-astronauts. Some of them are basket cases now.
Television. Strange thing about television is that it doesn't tell you everything. It shows you everything about life on Earth, but the true mysteries remain. Perhaps it's in the nature of television. Just waves in space. Do you trust me, Dr. Price?
I think so.
That's not good enough.
It's the best I can do. Let's put it this way. I want to. You see, Mr. Newton, I'm kind of a cliche. I'm the disillusioned scientist that goes
okay,
with...
Okay. There is the last line in this where he speaks in Latin and he talks about traveling into the stars. And it's quite significant as it joins the two, the beginning to the end. But anyway, that's it.
All right. I just would like to get an idea of, like, who is up there tonight. So how many people that are here are from Adelaide? If you don't mind. Okay. And how many of you would, or how many people, not just from the ones from Adelaide, but everyone, how many people here are artists or self-describe as artists? Isaac? And how many of you are filmmakers, which could be the same people as the artists? How many of the filmmakers would not ever self-describe as artists? None, okay. Just curious. That was fun. I wish I had more questions. This is just a slide of an exhibition I'm not going to talk about called Optimism that I did in the fall at a venue called Westport Art Center in the U.S. Just to run through a few of the projects I've done. This is a slide from a project I did called The New Normal, which opened at Artist Space last April, and it's an exploration of privacy through 13 artist works. I'm just going to talk about two quick examples. It's obviously an exhibition that brings together works in a range of media. One of my favorites is a piece by Jennifer and Kevin McCoy, who I'm going to talk about twice today, which is this piece called Vice Presidential Downtime Requirements. And it's from a series which is based on leaked documents which they download off the internet, which are the rider agreements that artists or musicians or public speakers use when they go on tour to a venue. So these are their requirements for their dressing room or their kind of relaxation area. And Dick Cheney's hospitality requirements for when he makes public appearances were leaked on the internet. And so they take these leaked documents and they assemble in the gallery all of the objects that person would need for their stay. And this is actually an installation view from Huarte in Spain. And what I love about this is that on the, first of all, the hardest one is all televisions have to be tuned to Fox News, so we have to get satellite TV everywhere. But then, it asks for a queen-size bed or a king-size bed. And when the director of the venue came in and saw the sheets that we had like found from, you know, somewhere for the show. He said, this is no kind of way to treat a busy vice president. And he went out with his own money. He bought these like high thread count sheets for the exhibition. So I thought that was quite funny. But what's interesting about this is like how basically Dick Cheney, his personality needs like reflect a person with like zero personality. You know, because writer agreements are always like a reflection of the id of the artist. I want 30,000 green M&Ms, you know, 12 strippers, a stack of porno movies. But Dick Cheney is like, diet caffeine-free Sprite, restaurant menu, ice. This is another work by an artist named Kota Izawa, who is based in San Francisco. And this work is an animation based, which is sort of like reanimating the honeymoon video that Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee made and leaked on the internet. So a lot of the works are using or appropriating private information, which is available on the web. Others use private information in the service of self-portraiture. And this exhibition is available between November and March or April of next year, if anyone's interested in bringing it to Australia. It just opened yesterday in Columbus, Ohio. Can you guys hear me okay, by the way? Yeah? Okay. I'm currently working with Acme on their exciting new permanent exhibition, which is due to open in the middle of this year, called Moving Worlds, which is sort of an exploration of the history and experience of the moving image, looking at film, television, video games, and new media. This is a rendering from one of the sections of the exhibition called Sensation, which really looks at the moving image as a sensory experience or an aesthetic experience. This is a rendering of an area which is looking at more of an overall history of the international moving image from 2,000 years ago to the present day. Before I was an independent curator, I was living in London, working at the British Film Institute as head of exhibitions. And while there, I worked on a capital project, which was the development of several new spaces, which expanded the venue formerly known as National Film Theater. It took over the space that used to be the Museum of the Moving Image, and we added a white cube gallery, a black box small screening area, which is playing this horrible movie by Mel Gibson. It's just, this is like representation of indigenous Mexicans, I think. It's like, how can you possibly get away with that? And also a third space called the Mediatek, which is another viewing paradigm, where we show digitized material at personal viewing stations that people can access on demand. It opened with 200 hours, and they add about 100 hours each month. And I project managed the sort of the logistics, or the, I guess, the software and hardware and the build of this space, and worked with a curator named Robin Baker who did the content. And this space was designed by David Adjaye. Now, the National Film Theater is kind of known as like a purist cinema venue. And I'd like to ask you guys a question. Which do you think would be more controversial to the members of the NFT who really value cinema as a pure experience? Would it be a gallery which is like devoted to kind of emerging forms of practice, and you know, multiple screen installations and that sort of thing? Or would it be a Mediatek devoted, which is kind of a celebration of the history of film? So who thinks the gallery is more controversial at the NFT? And who thinks the Mediatek? The answer is the Mediatek. Quentin knew. Because we are digitizing material, which is obviously a translation of that material from its original context. You know, obviously there's an argument about access and experience, which rages on in film archives all around the world. One of the opening project at BFI South Bank's gallery, where Wynette Walworth actually did the second show, was actually another exhibition by Jennifer and Kevin McCoy, in which they showed the work that you saw earlier, a few slides ago in the foyer, but also this series called the Traffic Series, which recreates these moments from their lives in which viewing cinema or television has kind of coincided with, you know, other personal events. So one of the pieces is based on their first date, their second date, when they went to go see Godard's film Weekend. And you can, so this is basically like a kind of robotic animated film set. And in this area, you can see that they have this like turntable, which is recreating the famous tracking shot from Weekend. And then there's miniatures of Jennifer and Kevin here watching Weekend on this little cinema in Paris. And then all of this is fed through to a mixer, which sends a kind of edited sequence showing the film world and the spectator world as a kind of film about that moment of viewing. And what I think is really nice about this project is it really speaks to the hybridity of the viewing experience. I love this quote by Paul Hammond, who's a writer, kind of a surrealist writer based in the UK. Alone in a crowd is never so intense as at the movies, and never so open to sudden dislocation. It is the complex play between me, you, them, the film, the cinema building, and the world outside that enables us, on occasion, to experience reality more completely. So what I want to quickly run through is, I think this idea that the cinema building actually plays a role in the experience of watching a movie is kind of crucial, because if you're an artist and you create experiences, then you can't leave your it kind of follows on from that idea. If the cinema building is part of the experience of viewing, then the artist needs to think through the space of viewing as well as the space on screen if they want to really control the experience fully. So I'm going to quickly talk through four quick examples of approaches that artists can have to the physical space in which their work is seen. In scenario one, the artist decides to take total control over the viewing space to create an installation. And I just wanted to like really make this point that in the kind of practice of artist moving image installation, which we've now sort of seen in, you know, evolve into an accepted mode of presentation, when an artist makes a moving image work, it's kind of accepted that when the work moves into a collection, what the collection will get is the disc or the, you know, whatever media format the work comes with, but also a floor plan or an architectural diagram that specifies how the work needs to be presented. So the work itself is not just the moving image work, but also this sort of architectural diagram created by the artist. This is an example of a work by Fishley and Weiss, but it's from a catalog of an exhibition that showed work from the Ingvild Goetz collection, which is one of the leading kind of private collections of artists, film, and video based in Germany. And every single work in this publication of like 250 major pieces, every single work had a diagram, either most of them not done by hand, most of them like a kind of CAD program. So definitely the idea of the moving image artist as architect has kind of evolved pretty quickly into an accepted mode of practice. The flip side of the coin, the artist does not care or does not take any role in determining that environment. And that's something that, here's an example of an artist named Ryan Tricarton, and I don't know if I really have time to show his piece. Okay. It's really funny. So I saw this piece in the cinema for the first time. It's also shown as it's also sold as a limited edition DVD and shown in a gallery space. But this is
really groovy as well. Patty Mae, I hate you so much.
What about her?
I never waste my time with people who are muddy or inconvenient.
I'm not mud, it's dirt.
I fell down a hill.
So what? Skipping over that fucking fuck door of yours.
Never. This is the worst day of my life.
Skippy, open the freaking door!
Yeah, I have to go now.
Uh-huh, me too.
Good! Skippy, your music friends are leaving because the show is a boring whore.
People make peace, and then they fall asleep. Yeah. I'm not 16 anymore, but I feel like I'm 5 with sunglasses on.
All right, Ryan Tricarton. So he doesn't necessarily control the physical context in which his work is shown. And there's, obviously like an advantage to that, which is that if you want your work to be seen by a really wide audience, you can't necessarily control the exhibition of it each time. That's why in the film industry, the division of labor between production and exhibition emerged so quickly. You know, it was even when the Lumiere brothers were sending agents around the world, those agents would shoot their own films, and then they would also control the context in which they were shown, but they'd also send them back to the headquarters to be shown by another agent. So in order to really reach that wide audience, it's very difficult to really, you know, to mandate the architecture of the work in each way. And I think that's why, you know, what Isaac's doing is interesting. He has the kind of architectural version and then other versions of the work sometimes that can travel around in different ways. So that's kind of a binary, I guess, moving image artist as architect and then, you know, not taking a stake in the architecture. But the third scenario is the idea of, well, basically what that leaves out is that sometimes spaces that are not designed by the artist have their own specificity, which is, you know, and I guess one of the things I was thinking about this panel is a quote by Raymond Bellore in which he says that the cinema is just an installation that was institutionalized very quickly. You know, the cinema, the black box, has its own architectural language, and sometimes work is designed for that space. So the example of, I guess the third scenario is that sometimes an artist isn't controlling the design of the viewing environment, but it's made to work within a specific viewing environment nonetheless. And the example I want to use is a piece from a project called Fernsehgalerie Gallery, which was, there's people watching Ryan Tricarton's video on Tokyo Subway. Oh, these three are watching Ryan Tricarton's video, and she's actually watching Carolee Schneemann. No, I just completely lied. Do you think that people are watching Carolee Schneemann on the Tokyo subway? She's right now. She's watching somebody, Carolee Schneemann, pulling a theoretical text from her vagina. That's what she's watching. Raw performance art. So the Fernsehgalerie Gallery is a project in the late '60s by a filmmaker from Berlin named Gary Schum that wanted to create a television gallery. And this is like his original notes about the project and why he wanted to do it. And I think it's really interesting because it was like, it was sort of a response to this really logistical concern about showing artwork in Berlin. It's hard to ship it there because it's like, you know, it has to be basically airlifted or, you know, there's problems. It's hard to get audiences there from outside Berlin. So that's why he wants to create this other space. So he's trying to leave behind the exhibition architecture and move entirely into a broadcast space, which is dematerialized. And his first show kind of moves beyond the idea of representing artwork and instead moves into working with artists that are using moving image as their medium. So his first show was with people like Robert Smithson and Dennis Oppenheim and Richard Long, and was all about land art. But his second show involved this piece by Jan Dibitz from 1969, in which he basically turned the TV into a fireplace. And I think this piece is really interesting because it actually is like really rematerializing the Fernsehgalerie Gallery. The piece is a response to the way that the television was seen as a displacement of domestic architecture, which used to be centered around the hearth. And then with the introduction of television, the television increasingly became the focal point of domestic architecture in the living room. So this piece is really an intervention into domestic architecture. So even though he was working in this dematerialized art gallery, it's very much a piece about a specific viewing architecture that wouldn't really make sense in a sort of white cube environment. It's five now, so that was my 15 minutes. And I have one more example, but we could stop, or what should we do? Okay. The last one is Jody, who are they're artists that work online. They started working on the internet in the kind of early to mid-90s. This is one of their early works from 1995. It's called Location, although you can never really tell with Jody. Basically, you'd go to this webpage, it would be 1995, you'd be like, this webpage is broken. And let me see what's wrong with their computer code, and then I can tell them how to fix it. And you'd look at the source, and you would see that the computer code that generated this site was actually a diagram of an atomic bomb. So that's one of the, you know, an example of some of the ways they were kind of playing around with the internet at that point in time. Now, Jody, you were part of the scene of European net artists. You might think that that work doesn't seem necessarily architecturally specific, and so they were approached by Documenta in 1997 to show the piece as part of a special exhibition called Internet Documenta, and they agreed, and the work was shown in this environment, which was like a recreated office in the gallery. And this is Jody's response to that. They describe it as a joke that's not funny, and basically they compare it to the way that video installations were shown in living room-like environments in the gallery. So they were not kind of happy about that translation. So even though the work was sort of seen generally in an office environment, when you recreate that environment in the White Cube, it becomes a translation of that experience. It's not an exact approximation of it. And I think that's interesting because, like, the White Cube is a space where everything you present is seen as a decision. There's nothing you can do that's working with the default language of the space. Or maybe there is, but I don't exactly know what that is for moving image artists. The gallery aspires to a condition of placelessness, of being a non-architectural entity, and the artist is supposed to be allowed to come in and create the architecture. But what I think is sort of interesting is that even if the gallery aspires to this condition of placelessness, it rarely achieves it. And the real building that you result in is always this kind of compromise or a failure between the aspiration to be a placeless, zero, complete ground upon which the artist constructs something, and the realities of the building process, which create imperfections and irregularities and specificities. So Jody actually, the kind of addendum to this story is that Jody in 2003 did an exhibition at FACT, and I was unaware at the time, I was the curator of that show, and I was unaware at the time of their past history with Documenta and the office installation. And they were working in a perfect cube gallery space with, you know, very minimal architectural language of its own. And what do you think Jody decided to do for their installation? An office! So these are office cubicles set up here, and there are different works on display in each one. So that's all I wanted to present. It's my, I had these, we're skipping this. That's my email. Thank you. Sure.
Hello. Oh, is this?
We only have a few moments, about 5 minutes, I think. So if anyone needs to leave, have a seat quickly now. But we're going to lose a lot.
Maybe we should just move the discussion to happy hour.
Is there any really burning questions? Do people have questions? Isaac.
Yep. I was really kind of up and just meaning for the like what you keep yourself in mind.
Oh gosh.
I should sort of installation happened there that I saw recently about the work of the slide, but it's just that there's been no discussion. We've just spoken about the work and the work film, which has been going on for some time now, I think. We've sort of had that media day and the relationship. That's been,
well, I think Second Life is, first of all, it's like primarily interesting as a gambling client, but now that's become illegal, so its moment in the sun is gone. But it's also interesting, I think, as an architectural space, like as a space for experimental architecture to happen, because basically it's a place where lots of people are building buildings in interesting ways. So I think, I kind of like that idea that it's like an architectural sandbox for the masses. But I think the problem about like presenting artwork in this space is that it's like, there's logistical problems which are huge. It's really hard if you're getting someone that's new to Second Life to, if you say, come to my exhibition, it can be really hard for a newcomer to find an exhibition in Second Life. So it's like, basically, they would need like a tutorial in order to even navigate this enormous landscape of virtual architecture to get to the right place.
And then there's like funny things like limitations on the number of people that can be in one space at the same time, because it like creates a huge drain, I think, on the second wave servers. So, you know, you can only like have 10 people at your show. So I think, you know, they haven't really ironed that stuff out. I guess I would say that I think they're, yeah, there is something interesting there, but it's sort of like not quite happening. So I think a lot of these things, someone was saying that, you know, we anticipate these media technologies, and then when they arrive, they're so readily adopted. And I think that's because they get promised to us for a really long period of time before they're really ready. You know, people were getting promised television by like 1900, and then they're like, when are we getting TV? And it was like 1956, you know, and it's really before they kick it. And I think we're now getting promised virtual worlds, and it'll be like maybe a little bit longer before they're really engineered to the level we can have like a really awesome exhibition where a lot of people can join in this virtual space and have the immersive experience. The problem also is that you're experiencing it in the frame of your own computer. And it's not ever going to. The thing about art, yeah, you really have. I think Second Life, sorry, maybe I'm talking too much about this, but it's also denying the hybridity of viewing experience. You know, it says like your viewing experience takes place entirely within the space, the virtual space of the screen, and it's denying that your experience also like involves your body. I think like a big thing about online gamers is that there's like a desire to be disembodied by the moving image, and I don't think that ever really happens. If you are wearing a virtual reality helmet, someone can still pinch your butt, you know?
Yeah.
Do you have a follow-up?
Actually, there's a second question, really, which is just a nice living tutorial of the methods of the practices of the jungle art for students. So I'm talking to the whole cinema, just kind of, it's deep down the old references to YouTube. And so that's completely, you know, like something kind of discussed where the references are being made, you know, the creates the cinema, really. So,
I think I agree.
Yeah. Really, it's very, I mean, there a lot to, you know, to hear that all the references are all connected.
I think it's sort of amazing how much of film history is, you know, is now represented in some way on the internet. You know, there's this real movement towards that, which it always surprises me because you think like, and, you know, the copyright holders are, you'd think that they would shut it down much more ardently than they do, I think. But because, like, now it's at a critical mass where I think if something's not represented on the internet, it's almost like it becomes forgotten. And then, because people that are writing their papers for film history class, I'm sure they're using.
They've looked at the text with this strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
The collage version, the sort of all the work that I've seen, like, the tutorial, like, in that way.
I think that's very different from what's happening in other places. But the thing about YouTube, of course, is that it's out of that desire for this encyclopedia of something that might prefer to cinema or any moving image culture, but it's not, it can't be cinema itself. It can be a facsimile perhaps. But it's, I think it's probably gesturing towards something that is emerging at the moment. That might be, you know, have more fidelity, but it still won't be whatever cinema is. So we didn't want it to be there. No, but if cinema is this hybrid thing that keeps getting redefined by new technologies and new social and cultural situations, then, you know, I think that's where there is some possibility for those sorts of venues to be, you know, occupied by the artists or to be used in more intensive ways.
But they are.
Yeah. They are, exactly.
But maybe there's a. It's a publishing platform.
Yeah.
And, I mean, certainly in Australia, we're very poor at publishing our work.
And distributing.
Yeah. So,
of course,
I was a huge Christian.
Yeah.
It was absolute organic part of our culture, like these things, not to be quite like in Europe. In the still philosophical society in this country, I would argue it's one of the critical ones. I'm interested in your point. Why are you so interested in architecture in terms of the shifting modes of architecture and the representation of cinema? Because my experience of architects, I mean, the town sense, master builder, they're not diabetic buildings.
Well, I think, I guess I was using architecture in a loose term, and I'm sort of interested in amateur architecture, or the physical spaces we construct around the world, not necessarily designed by an architect with a capital A.
But if you look at model building in terms of classical cinema,
yeah,
for example, etc. These are questions already embedded in those model sets.
Yeah, I think that. Well, one of the things I would say to that is that there is like on screen, there's architecture on screen as well as architecture off screen. And so I was drawing a distinction which I didn't really clarify between on-screen architecture, which is another whole realm of discourse, and off-screen architecture, which is what my talk was about.
It's a very complex question.
Yeah. I think sometimes there's like no real relationship implied between the on-screen architecture and the off-screen. And then sometimes, or you know, explicitly implied by the maker.
Have you met Paul Hammond?
I haven't. Do you know him?
No, it's worth Shadow.
Yeah. I think that's not that.
No, it's okay. Maybe we should. I mean, I think that's probably a good place to finish Space Place after Raphael kicking off last night, finished within that sort of space of architecture and projection and shadow. And I thank all the three speakers this afternoon for presenting something about the multiplicitous nature of the kind of conversation that we've been having from Catherine's really wonderful spaces at GOMO, where screens create new sight lines, to Joyce's really sensational examples of her practice, and to where kind of Michael has taken us to another set of discourse altogether. So I'd ask you to give them a round of applause.
Thanks everyone. I know it's been a very full day, and you know, we've tried to get too much in, but I think, you know, obviously it's a very fertile topic for discussion, and I hope that, you know, you all take something away from today. And once again, I'd like to thank Soundstage, BigCon, Adelaide Film Festival, and the Australian Council as well for the visual art. But I thank also to our fantastic speakers, who've come from far and wide.
Thanks to you. Goodbye.